Council, when you're ready, you may proceed. Oh, and I also should note for this case, because there are two appeals, so I'll call the first appeal. So this is going to be 24-6584, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, then we'll finish this appeal, then we'll move on to the other one at that point. Because I think we have different lawyers. Is that correct? For the second appeal, we have different lawyers?
Not on our side.
Make sure.
On the plaintiff's side, I will represent the plaintiffs, and Mr. Ludden will represent.
Okay, I couldn't see behind the sign. That's why I was confused about.
Just, you know,
okay.
I don't want to be disrespectful.
All right.
That's sort of the way it works.
Sorry, I didn't. I literally could not see you behind the sign.
Right. And
we're
splitting our time on the second.
On the second. Okay, very good. All right. So I'm going to ask Ms. Lawler and Sam, we all said otherwise? All right. Here we go. You may proceed, counsel.
Good morning and thank you. If it please the court, my name is Michael Hoy. I represent the plaintiffs and appellants in this appeal, David Seamus and Metalast, Inc. I want to start with a short apology for the briefing, my briefing. I don't think it served the court very well. I don't think it was direct as it could have been. And so today I want to take my time to try and simplify the case and put it into the proper analytical order. The cardinal rule of res judicata is that it can never preclude claims that accrue after the initiation of the prior action. We argued this in briefing to the district court. We never had an oral argument. But that principle, that cardinal rule, seemed to be lost in the order granting the motions to dismiss. And the practical implication of that rule is that if there were claims that accrued before the prior action commenced, and then claims that accrued after the prior action commenced, it would be theoretically appropriate to bar only those claims that had accrued prior to the prior action, but never apply that rule to those claims that accrued only after the action had begun. And this takes on special force in trademark cases, as the court in Lucky Brand Dunkaroos pointed out. The Supreme Court said, in a trademark case, whether there is an infringement will depend upon the market conditions at the time of the infringement. So if you have infringements before the prior action, maybe those are precluded. But as to claims that happen after the case is commenced, you can never later preclude those claims based on res judicata. The district court really focused a lot on this idea of common nucleus of facts. And the court also said that res judicata precludes claims that were made or could have been made in the prior action. Well, the common nucleus of facts applies to the facts leading to the accrual of the action. It doesn't refer in the cases to the common nucleus of facts that are pleaded as the elements of claims within the case. And I want to elaborate on that a little bit more in a few minutes. And then finally, we have this rule that in infringement cases, as this court has held, at least in the copyright area, a trademark owner or a copyright owner is always entitled to sue separate infringers in separate actions. And that's true even if those infringers are all part of the same chain of distribution.
I want to drill down a little bit on the accrual date that you're advocating for. My understanding from the briefing is that you think that the accrual date is when that prior action started, so when the complaint was filed. Is that right?
I think that's incorrect, Your Honor. I think that the defendants in this case are trying to give preclusive effect to Mr. Seamus's counterclaim in the prior action. And so the counterclaim for infringement against Chemion Surface Technology would be the prior action that we're talking about.
Okay, so that's a good clarification. So it's not the complaint. You agree that it's the filing of the counterclaim?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Before we get any further into claim preclusion, why shouldn't we resolve this case on issue preclusion, because you didn't contest that to the district court?
Because that should be decided by the district court in the first instance.
Well, I guess I'm not sure I agree with that, because the defendants raised multiple defenses and only got an answer on one of them from the district court, but that doesn't mean that they didn't raise multiple defenses and you didn't address one of them. And so we have case law that says that if an issue isn't addressed, it's abandoned. And so I think the case law would allow us to, regardless of what the district court did, to say issue preclusion was never challenged, and so that defense prevails as a procedural matter.
Except that issue preclusion is a mixed question of fact and law. And this court doesn't have a factual record, an evidentiary record before it.
Right. It would be a procedural ruling, basically of a forfeiture issue.
Issue preclusion still can't preclude claims that accrue after the first action begins.
I guess I'll phrase it this way. They raised multiple defenses. One was claim preclusion. One was issue preclusion. You responded to claim preclusion, but you did not respond, as I understand, before the district court to issue preclusion. On appeal, one of the defendants is saying, look, we had this defense. He didn't respond to it. That's a waiver of that's a waiver to that. We win. Why is that wrong?
It's wrong because the elements of issue preclusion are not there.
But that's a different, okay. Whether or not the defense is meritorious or not, if it had been properly litigated, is one thing. A different question, which is what I think they're raising in their brief, is you did not respond at all. And in our system, when you don't respond to a defense or an argument, you're basically conceding it. So why wasn't that a concession before? I understand you may have arguments as to why, if it was properly preserved, we can fight it, but was it properly preserved?
I did not address issue preclusion head on in the district court, true. But it is all wrapped up in the preclusive impact of the prior action.
Is there any indication why the district court didn't address issue preclusion? Because it was raised.
It was raised. I can only speculate about that, Your Honor. I can't get into the district judge's head. So, the fundamental problem here is that the district court's order seems to confuse claim accrual with claim articulation. And again, when the court was talking about the common nucleus of facts, the court was only looking at those cases where the claims that had accrued prior to the prior action had similarities to the follow-on claim. And if you look through the district court order, every single one of those cases involved claims that had accrued before. The TRPA case, Judge Reinhardt said, look at these are just facial challenges to a regulatory scheme. You're not raising anything new, except that you're raising new elements of new claims. But the factual basis for the claim has been litigated for years and years. Same thing with the Turtle Island case. Again, it was just a facial challenge to regulations. Constantini, multiple cases for 17 years arising out of the same transaction and occurrence. And then the court even cited Holcomb versus Hosmer, which doesn't even apply federal law. It applies Nevada law of res judicata, which is different than federal law. So in Desire LLC, this court said that a trademark I'm sorry, that all of the infringers who share a common chain of distribution can be sued in separate cases. So if you start talking about issue preclusion as opposed to claim preclusion, it's the same thing. You can't have the common issues as to claims that are made against a different infringer. You can't have a common nucleus of facts going to the elements of the claim as to those infringements that arise after the commencement of the first case. And then I want to, I've got 40 seconds left.
Before you run out of time, I have one question for you on the privity side of this standard for claim preclusion. So the Taylor case gives some examples of when there's privity. And I'm curious, I think that your position is that those are just examples that the Supreme Court gave in terms of when you're, you know, representing someone else in a representative capacity. But I wanted to make sure I understand your argument on that point. Is it your position that those examples that the Supreme Court gave are just examples, or is it an exhaustive list, or how do we think about whether that element for representing someone else's interest is met?
The case gives six categories in which we can have non-party preclusion. I think that only the second category is the one that matters to this case, and that is when there has been such a relationship between the defendants, I'm sorry, in that case, the plaintiffs in the first case and the plaintiffs in the second case. But that principle has also been applied in this court in Federal Trade Commission against Garvey, applying that principle to defendants. And in that case was similar to our case in the sense that the argument was, well, the counter defendant in the first action is indemnifying the defendants in the second action. In other words, in this case, Chemion is indemnifying Chemetall, Albemarle, and the rest of the distributor defendants. And first of all, there's no record of that as to all of those defendants. But in FTC versus Garvey, the court said, we're only going to look at an indemnity agreement as a reason to show this connection between defendants in that case if, in the first action, the indemnitor was being sued in its capacity as the indemnitor. And so that didn't happen here.
Let me jump in. I'm going to give you 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
I'm going to give you some extra time. Why don't we take a break now, and let's hear from the other side.
Thank you.
And I just want to make sure on the day sheet it says 9 minutes.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, because I want to make sure the timer says 7.
It does say 7.
There we go. Bingo.
May it please the court, Adam Hosmerhenner for the distributor defendants and my colleague on behalf of Albemarle will present for 1 minute on the issue of sufficiency of the pleadings. The first judge to consider this second Nevada action, Judge Stanton in California, held that the case was virtually identical and largely duplicative of the first Nevada action that was filed in the Chemion case and found that it was a thinly veiled attempt.
One moment, if we can start the clock. Continue.
To construe the case as a separate dispute by not naming Chemion as a party. The second judge to consider this case, Judge Baldwin, the magistrate judge in the District of Nevada, found that the cases were substantially similar and stayed the Chemetall action, pending the result and the outcome of the first Nevada action because that could influence the decision in this action. When that actually was decided, both by the district court and then affirmed in part on appeal at the Ninth Circuit, Judge Baldwin lifted the stay and resolved this case based on preclusion principles, based on what she and Judge Stanton had already recognized, that this case was largely identical to what was already being litigated in the District of Nevada in the first Nevada action.
Do you have any sense of why the district court did not discuss issue preclusion?
I don't, Your Honor. All I can say is that in the order, the court finds that claim preclusion is sufficient and specifically references that she doesn't address the other issues that could have been resolved in the case. But we do think that this court can and should resolve the case on issue preclusion alone, as that was conceded and we heard no explanation.
On the merits, issue preclusion has some problems. Do we care about that in this context where we've got a waiver problem?
I don't think we do procedurally on this problem, and I'm happy to address those to the extent the court wants to get into those, although I don't think we need to because of that complete waiver, both really at the district court and on appeal as well. One of the saving arguments that was made kind of in the briefing and here today is this idea that there is a global issue with respect to all the preclusion arguments, that they cannot be based on conduct and claims that have accrued after the date of the operative complaint. We don't believe that's true and argued in our briefs that it's not, because issue preclusion relates to the issue that was actually litigated regardless of whether the subsequent claim was.
Well, if you get into the merits of issue preclusion, that's where I have a problem of actually litigated, right? Because the claims that we care about were voluntarily dismissed in that first action, and case law pretty clearly establishes that if something is voluntarily dismissed and there has been no findings of fact, it's not actually litigated, and that's a requirement for issue preclusion, which is why I'm not quite sure what to do with this issue, because on the merits, I don't know about that issue, but on the procedure, it seems pretty clear that the other side didn't deal with it, and our case law would allow us to say, well, you've abandoned that issue.
Well, we certainly would love to win on procedure and think that we can there. On the merits, I will say that there really are two sides of the same coin with respect to preclusion, with respect to the litigation of the actual issue. The first is the voluntary dismissal via the stipulation, but really the second is the summary judgment motion for the declaratory judgment in favor of Kimeon on the issue of no infringement. That issue was resolved via motion practice and summary judgment, and while the district court actually decided based on this, the premise that the corresponding counterclaims had already been dismissed, there were all the other issues that were litigated leading up to it. So there was a summary judgment grant in favor of Kimeon that didn't just rely upon that was somewhat different than the dismissal, voluntary dismissal of the claims. And that case actually was then litigated to trial, where at trial, the declaratory judgment, although it had already been granted via summary judgment, continued at trial because there was still a determination of whether there should be a finding of an exceptional case in that trial related to the declaratory judgment thing. So because of that, we think if we were to get into the merits, there is more than just that pure stipulation saying that we're going to voluntarily dismiss the claims and that these things were adequately litigated to the court.
Would you address the accrual point? Because I'm not quite sure I understand the basis for the argument for where you want to point to the where times, where, you know, the trigger point for when something accrues.
Well, we think Media Rights versus Microsoft that has the key language, and that is that claims can't be barred based on preclusion when they accrue after the operative complaint in the prior action. Here, the operative complaint was the third amended complaint that was filed in 2019.
Why shouldn't we look at? I recognize that the language in the case law talks about operative complaint. I think there's a Supreme Court case that talks about initiating complaint or the initial complaint or initial pleading or something like that. But those cases don't deal with counterclaims. And this case, the preclusion issues are all about counterclaims. So why shouldn't we actually look at this and address it in terms of the operative pleading document that is what the preclusion issues are all about, which is the counterclaims?
I would just briefly respond that I think the preclusion issues can be founded on that affirmative claim for declaratory judgment and no infringement as well. But there are three triggering dates. The first is the initiation of the complaint, the commencement of the action in 2015 by Kimeon. The second would be the filing of the counterclaims by CMS and Medlast also in 2015. And then the third accrual date under media rights would be that October 2019 date for the filing of the third amended complaint. And that one did have the claim for declaratory judgment as to non-infringement, and it did provide the opportunity to respond and file counterclaims again in that time. I recognize the case law is not extremely helpful to our side on that point in terms of that being a discretionary counterclaim, perhaps, that would be filed in 2019. But what I will say is that this accrual conversation about the specific date on which the claims accrue is really missing the point about what actually accrued. What we don't have from the other side is an argument that the claims didn't accrue until after 2015. In fact, there's no real argumentation anywhere that these claims hadn't already accrued. We have these generic recitations of copyright cases where each new instance of an infringement constitutes a new cause of action. But what the court found below was there's no explanation of any new claims or any conduct that accrued after November 2019. And the court chose that date because the court chose was basing its legal decision on the premise that that's when the counterclaims could have been filed. But that's not necessarily the binding upon this court, obviously. And if the court were to choose another date, the same argumentation would apply. There's no explanation as to whether anything accrued even after 2015. So what we never heard from the other side is there actually is some conduct, like in media rights, where there is a different set of infringement, a different product, a different kind of infringement, or a different use.
Well, okay, so I have a couple of notes about some allegations in the complaint. Quote, even after the plaintiffs commenced this suit, the defendants continued to advertise, market, sell, label, and an invoice for products identifying as formerly Medilast. So why isn't that enough at the pleading stage to indicate that there is further activity beyond that occurred beyond the accrual date that you want to focus on?
The first response is that's the same conduct here because it's the exact same phrase, formerly Medilast, and we would analogize this closer to a situation where it's about the ownership of a mark, that then if that's resolved, would resolve all future claims, as opposed to a situation where infringement is done on some sort of continuous basis of conduct, and each infringement forms a new sort of type of action. And the other part of preclusion is the guiding principle here is we don't want to have inconsistent judgments, and we want to use preclusion in a way that preserves the rights and victories that a party obtained in the prior litigation. What would accepting Seamus's argument and appellant's argument on the other side would mean that you would have a victory for the manufacturer in the sense that they could advertise their products as formerly Medilast, but they could not use their distributors who, according to the complaint, all of whom were being used as distributors even in the first action. Those distributors couldn't use the exact same label, the exact same packaging, and the exact same marketing material that the court approved of via the summary judgment and the stipulation for dismissal in the first action. Briefly, Your Honor, I wanted to address privity, and with my remaining time, would just like to say that with respect to privity, all the case law supports that this is a flexible concept that depends on a case-by-case analysis, whether it's a parent and subsidiary or here a manufacturer and distributor. The analysis isn't rigid and set into certain categories and only those categories where you can establish privity. Instead, it's whether there is an alignment of interest and whether there was adequate representation. Here, the appellants themselves in their complaint in the second action said the first action was about whether Kimeon and its distributors could use the phrase formerly Medilast. And for that reason, certainly there was an alignment of interest and certainly there was adequate representation as shown by the result.
Thank you very much. He's right on the dot. Oh, hold on. She gets her minute.
Good morning. May it please the court. Lindsay Calhoun on behalf of Albemarle Corporation. I'm going to join Mr. Hosmer Henner's argument as well. I just want
Counsel,
to raise...
Counsel, since your time is very short, I'm going to jump right in.
Sure.
I just have a practical question, which is why is your client doing its own thing in terms of briefing? Like, what was the goal there?
My client has separate counsel. We have been sort of separated from the other parties throughout. We've always had a separate counsel and separate representation, and that has just continued through the appellate stage as well.
All right. And so then the result is that you've taken a little bit different approach on a couple of these issues, and I'm trying to figure out what to make of that. And so let's focus on issue preclusion. You don't press that on appeal.
We don't press that on appeal, but we would join the appellee's argument on that. We think that the allegations basically rise and fall as to all the defendants.
But why shouldn't we say that you've waived that issue by not raising it on appeal?
I would argue that the appellees do intend to adopt each other's arguments we would join in that argument as well.
Did you join formally the brief or say that you're incorporating the arguments?
I cannot recall all the language of the brief, but I do believe we had the intention to join the arguments raised by our co-appellees as we had done before the district court as well. We had each joined each other's arguments. With my remaining time, I'll just mention that the complaint does not contain sufficient allegations against Albemarle or any other defendant. There's a group pleading style that's been held to be inadequate under Iqbal and Twombly. We would offer that this is a separate ground for the court to affirm the dismissal with prejudice by the district court. The appellants have had two chances to amend. They have not adequately alleged their claims in this case. And so we offer that as an alternative resolution for this appeal as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, so we'll have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to address a couple of talking points from the other side about what the pleadings in the first case say. Kemion's second claim for relief was unique to Kemion. Kemion said, we have a history that ties us to the Metalast brand, and so we are entitled to call ourselves formerly Metalast, and we are entitled to sell products labeled as formerly Metalast. But that is unique to Kemion because its name was once Metalast Surface Technologies. And that entity bought assets from a company called Metalast LLC, Metalast International LLC. That's why that claim is unique to Kemion. Has nothing to do with the distributors. There was some talk about the summary judgment motion in favor of Kemion on that claim, and the district court merely said, it looks like Seamus has dismissed his counterclaim for infringement against Kemion, and so I'm granting summary judgment based on that. It's moot. The claim is moot. Now, when we get to the trial, after years and years of discovery, the district court said, I find for the defendants, Seamus, on Kemion's second claim for relief. And that's in the findings of fact and conclusions of law. Now let's turn to the counterclaim. The counterclaim does not allege, in the first action, the counterclaim does not allege anything about the distributors. In fact, it only, in the claim for relief, it says we're only going after Kemion and its agents and officers and members and so forth. Doesn't say anything about distributors. So that's discussion that was outside of the record and incorrect. The operative complaint, that's, as the court has noted, that's a fraught term. The operative complaint for trial was the third amended complaint. But this district court turned that operative complaint by Kemion into a springboard to say that Seamus must have reinstated his counterclaim and impleaded new parties and sued them all for infringements that had taken place up until whatever that date was, November of 2019. Well, Seamus already had a claim against the distributors. And it was being stayed the whole time. That's the red bar. And I apologize to the court. There's no way I can expect you to read any of the text on this from there. And this is against the application of the federal rules of civil procedure in so many different ways. There is no absolute right to amend a complaint, which an amendment is where you say, I have additional claims for relief based on a cause of action that accrued before the case began, as opposed to a supplemental complaint where you're alleging facts that have happened after the commencement of the case. And there's this court has said no litigant is required to ever file a supplemental complaint, no matter how related the claims are to the ones that are in the case. I see I'm already 40 seconds over.
I know. Counsel, we appreciate your argument in this matter. Unless my colleagues have any further questions. All right, so argument in this case is submitted. We're going to move on to the next appeal, so don't go too far. I think you're up first in the next one.
I am not, Your Honor.
Oh, you're there.
Mr. Ludden will go first.
Oh, okay, got it. The guy I can't see behind the sign. All right, so why don't we do this?
I'll have to watch you for a little bit. But
do we need the visual aid anymore for this argument?
We do not, Your Honor. At least I do not.
If we wouldn't mind just taking it down. We don't need to move the easel. Well, okay, easel also blocks it. Sam, would you mind just pulling that aside? Thank you, Sam. Okay, so now I will go ahead and call the next case, CMOS and Lazo versus Chemetall and Chemion, 25-2477, 25-4111, 25-4402. I believe I have that correct? Yeah, okay, good.
I wasn't listening to numbers, Your
and,
Honor.
And Mr. Ludden, you're going first.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, all right. And you've got your time, same thing, 6 minutes?
It says 6 minutes right here. I have 6 minutes. He's going to have two more, and then we're reserving two more for rebuttal.
Okay, got it. I may just make a note of that here. Okay, and counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Tom Ludden on behalf of Mark Lazo. We've explained in our brief why there was no service at all of him regarding the motion, but for this argument, I'll just assume that the papers that were mailed did arrive in his office and argue from that perspective. The plaintiffs are going to argue that simply mailing that and that arriving would constitute sufficient service under Rule 4, and it doesn't for a variety of reasons. There's two ways to drag someone into a case involuntarily: service of a summons or service of a subpoena, and both of those require particular service and a particular document. And the federal rules require both documents state right on the front cover that you have been served and you must do something within a designated period of time, or a default will be entered to you, or you could be held in contempt of court. The motion that is filed, if we assume that it arrives in the office, is on a case my client has not been involved with for well over 2 years by that point. And there is no reason to conclude from reading it. It doesn't say that they're seeking, on the title, they're seeking fees from him. It doesn't say in the initial paragraph. It doesn't say until page 4 there's a single sentence, we would like fees for Mr. Lazo too. And you have to get to page 22 before they start arguing as to why fees are warranted as to Mr. Lazo. That isn't adequate. That wouldn't be an adequate way to do a summons or a subpoena, and it shouldn't be an adequate way to drag an attorney back into a case 2.5 years after he's out and hold him liable for $250,000, which is what happened here. And we know that there's a whole bunch of other documents filed regarding this motion. None of them are served, including an order setting a briefing schedule and the order finding him liable for almost $250,000.
Well, it all comes down to that motion, right? Because if the motion is properly served, then it doesn't matter that anything else wasn't properly served because your client never appeared.
Correct, Your Honor, and we've explained why we don't believe it's properly served.
Okay, but I'm just saying, I think you focus your argument on the motion itself because all the other stuff is going to the answer with regard to all the other pleadings or documents that were sent
right.
is tied to whether the motion was properly served or not.
Right, although there is a complete failure of anything else to be served. So, Your Honor, turning to sort of the merits here, this decision is based upon a finding that filing a lawsuit in one proper venue, because there were multiple, is so wrongful that it justifies making this an exceptional case under the Lanham Act and otherwise being grounds for awarding attorney fees. All of the case law, strike that, it is no more wrongful to file a case in one of the multiple venues than it is for a defendant to forum shop by removing a case from state court to federal court to judge shop and get the better federal judges to hear their case instead of the state court judges. That's the same sort of tactical decision that is made all the time by attorneys. It's not inappropriate to file the case here. It is specifically allowed to be filed in the Central District of California, and the transfer is done under 1404 for forum nonconvenience grounds.
So I want to make sure I understand your argument. We're on abuse of discretion review.
Right.
So I think your argument has to be that the district court made some sort of error of law.
Right.
And so is your argument boiling down to, so long as California wasn't adjudicated to be an improper venue, then there can be no basis for issuing fees on the selection of filing in California?
It is a proper venue. So filing in a proper venue.
The answer is yes.
Yes, the answer is yes. And if you review the case law, and we've gone and exhaustively explained them, you have a series of cases cited by the district court in which the case was filed in the wrong venue, or even venues where there was no personal jurisdiction. There was a transfer or a dismissal, and no attorney fees were awarded in any of those cases. Here we have a case filed in a proper venue, and yet that is held to be so wrongful that $250,000 in attorney fees is awarded.
Why doesn't it make a difference that there was already pending litigation involving the same issues and the same parties? Because I think some of the cases that you're talking about, you don't have that additional fact where there's already ongoing litigation that has to do with the same stuff and the same people, and you are like purposefully trying to find a different venue.
Two of them are Colorado River cases where there was ongoing litigation in state court, and where it was stayed under Colorado River, where they were finally refiling the suit in federal court. And in neither of those cases, which is actually a worse situation, were attorney fees awarded. So there's no case supporting this, where there is a filing in a proper venue being found to be so wrongful that you get $250,000 of attorney fees awarded. Just a couple more other points, Your Honor. There were no adverse rulings to be running away from in 2019 when this case was filed. There were subsequent decisions that happened in 2021, 22, 23. That's after the fact, and the decision that is supposedly wrongful is filing it here. There weren't any wrongful decisions at the time. There was nothing else to run away from. They were pursuing a claim against new defendants, and the venue was proper to pursue the claim against those defendants. And I have a red light. And
all right, fair enough.
I'd be happy to answer any questions, but.
All right, well, you've got your rebuttal time. You can decide how you want to do that with the co-counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Bye.
Again, Michael Hoy for David Seamus and Metalast, Inc. There was not ongoing litigation that compelled the filing of this new case in the District of Nevada. Trademark owners are entitled to sue the infringers in separate actions, and they're entitled to sue them where they find them. And three of the defendants are California corporations, and one or two others were qualified to practice in California. And in fact, California is where most of this commerce has taken place with these products. I want to talk about basic fairness here. Mr. Lazo, my client does not approve of his conduct in those investor cases that are discussed in the briefing. I don't approve of him. But what the district court did here is saddle my client, David Seamus, with sanctions for conduct by his former counsel. So far, that's probably appropriate. A client is saddled with his lawyer's conduct. But not in this case. Not in this case because his former lawyer's conduct was in different cases, not representing David Seamus. That misconduct was in cases representing other parties against Chemion and its owners. There is no precedent anywhere for this. And I completely understand and appreciate the standard of review here. An abuse of discretion. This is an abuse of discretion. This is so foul on its surface that it cannot stand. There's no directly demonstrable error of law because this hasn't happened before and there's no law that I know of against this. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Adam Osroener for the distributor defendants. Your Honor, I'd like to begin initially with the question of service on Mr. Lazo and go in the order that was largely addressed by my colleagues at bar. And the first is, we obviously agree that the key issue was the service of that motion. And the response we heard wasn't really that service was improper, because this is appropriate under the California Civil Code, as well as Rule 4 of the federal rules. The response was, you have to do something different if it's a subpoena or a complaint. In those circumstances, with a summons or a subpoena, we think those still could have been served in a similar fashion, and no additional notice was, no, it's not an issue with the service here, it's just an issue with what document was prepared to him. Because there isn't a subpoena, because there isn't a new summons, new piece of process, we're not sure what actually else could have been done by our clients to serve Mr. Lazo, short of doing exactly what we did, which is serve him at the address that he listed as his firm address and which he lists on his pleadings in this case. Service was made to that address, which turned out to be a UPS store, believing that he could be personally served there. And when he wasn't, a follow-up copy was mailed to that office in compliance with California rules, and there's no additional argument from the other side as to why that was improper. Thus, he was on notice, and the district court properly could take into consideration not only his conduct in this case and the credibility of his responses, but the entire history of his conduct in this and the other cases that he had appeared before. The second argument I'd like to make is about the issue of proper venue. This is not a situation where parties have filed in a proper venue and there are no other heightened issues or no other exacerbating conduct that would make that sanctionable. If we contrast this to the City Trends versus Coach case, in that case, there was gamesmanship about which party was going to get to the courthouse first. They both filed in separate venues in Maryland and California, and the court did not award attorney's fees because they said that was part of proper litigation. While it may be gamesmanship and sharp elbow tactics, it wasn't outside the norm of what a counsel would do for their clients. This is outside the norm because it's not just filing a case in California and claiming it to be proper venue. It's filing it while there is still pending litigation in Nevada, involving what the district court in California found to be virtually identical claims. And it follows a pattern of conduct by Mr. Lazo of filing cases in inconvenient forums and attempting to avoid prior decisions of the Nevada courts. It began with the first case was Alexander, which was a 2016 class action filed in the District of Nevada. After unfavorable rulings there, an almost identical class action was filed in the Harris case in Orange County State Court that then had to be removed to federal court and transferred back to Nevada. After that was transferred back to Nevada, Mr. Lazo filed another class action case, the Baker one, filed in a separate county, Los Angeles County, removed to federal court and transferred back to Nevada. This isn't a standalone issue of forum shopping. It's a pattern designed to harass and to intimidate and to try to coerce our clients into a settlement, improperly using the litigation forum to do so. And that was found by the court in the Baker decision, where it also awarded fees against Mr. Lazo for very similar conduct. And the district court, in taking into consideration the totality of the circumstances, was entitled to rely upon that other conduct in assessing the credibility of Mr. Lazo's claims.
So, counsel, let me jump in there. I appreciate your argument as to Mr. Lazo, but counsel for Mr. Seamus is raising the point that, look, you know, if my lawyer, my former lawyer, did bad things in other cases, had nothing to do with me, I should not be on the hook for that. I should only be on the hook for my cases, not this, I'll call 404B evidence, right? What's your response to that?
Twofold, Your Honor. And the first is, there's just the unusual circumstance of Mr. Seamus leaving a note in the complaint that wasn't removed in finalizing that complaint in this action, saying it could really shake the tree. And the explanation for that is some sort of explanation that note by Mr. Seamus saying this filing of a complaint could really shake the corporate tree of one of the German defendants is, we think, implausible, and the district court was within the discretion to find that comment alone stood as actual evidence, not circumstantial, that Mr. Seamus was aware of this conduct and thought that naming the distributors, especially in a California case, could do something to actually shake the tree, rattle the cages, and to achieve some sort of abnormal result. The second response to that is, this is not a situation where the other cases are being used to inform and to make the decision that that conduct in the other cases was part of the sanction award. It was designed to inform the court and test the credibility of the assertions in this case and the conduct in this case. And one of the arguments made by opposing counsel was there were no adverse rulings in the Nevada cases that Mr. Simas was trying to escape from. And we would submit the opposite, that actually in June 2018 was when the district court in the first Nevada action granted summary judgment on the declaratory judgment claim of no trademark infringement. This action was filed in November of 2018, a few months later, asserting the same type of infringement claims, using the same type of language about formerly Medilast against distributors and consciously not naming Kimeon, requiring Kimeon to intervene despite all the prior litigation. That, again, is evidence that the district court could properly take into consideration and use to inform its discretion in terms of whether this was a case where sanctions were appropriate for Mr. Simas and not just Lazo, because that was a case that Mr. Simas was involved in, resulting in the June 2018 summary judgment decision. And, of course, he was the named plaintiff in the November 2018 case that's this action. The next thing I would like to argue is this idea of kind of basic fairness and the argument that Mr. Hoy made concerning his client, that he's being unfairly punished for the conduct of his client. What we would say briefly is, you know, he was the one who most of the benefits would redound to, that he was the one who was seeking ownership and, if he had succeeded, would have reaped a windfall from the damages sought in this infringement claim. So it's not as if Mr. Lazo was acting for his own personal benefit. He was acting on behalf of his client, who was aware of and ratified his decisions in that case. And then I'd like to conclude briefly by addressing the cross appeal that was raised by our clients. And in that one, obviously, we don't have time to address all of the particular USPTO issues that were raised in there. But our point on oral argument is really this, is that the district court found that this was an exceptional case under the Lanham Act and found that the Nevada statute would have applied the same sort of analysis. And once that was the case, determined that even though it was an exceptional case where sanctions were warranted, only the first part of the case where the actual forum was in dispute warranted sanctions and limited attorney's fees to that period rather than the entire period. What we submit is that, especially an honor cross appeal, is that under the totality of the circumstances analysis, the district court needed to at least receive that evidence and consider it, whether the district court accepted or rejected it, but couldn't have found that it was irrelevant to the court's determination on whether it was an exceptional case and whether fees for the entire matter should have been considered and awarded. And that's because the case law is clear that it doesn't need to be an actually adjudicated issue of litigation in order to find the totality of the circumstances warrant the imposition of fees. It's because in many of these cases, the claims are so baseless, so meritless, that the district court can observe and exercise their discretion to determine that fees are appropriate given all of those circumstances. This case was dismissed on the pleadings and was properly done so. And even though the court found that the issue of preclusion wasn't an open and shut case and wasn't readily apparent to Mr. Simas and Mr. Lazo at the time the complaint was filed, largely in part because the first action hadn't yet resolved, and that's the reason the district court stated. What the district court still should have done is to take everything that was alleged and pled and that would have been part of the case, namely the cancellation of the trademarks, the alleged fraud upon the USPTO, and the other arguments that Kimeon raises, that those could have also been considered. So we do submit that it was error for the district court not to consider those additional arguments and to at least determine whether it was error to just limit fees to the initial period where the case was pending in the Central District of California. Unless this court has any additional questions.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michael Hoy, again, for David Simas and Medilast, Inc. I agree with my friend about something that really permeates these two appeals, and that is the district court, let me rephrase, the parties and their counsel would have preferred to build a better evidentiary record on all of these issues before dismissal or before an award of sanctions and fees. But it didn't happen, so we have the record that we have. But part of the record that we have is that Mr. Lazo, on behalf of my client, David Simas, filed this second infringement case in the Central District of California before he filed the serial class actions on behalf of investors. Okay, so I would argue that the court should have, and the district court said, I'm only finding exceptional case before the transfer, not and the case somehow becomes non-exceptional after the transfer. So that was the district court's way of saying, I'm only penalizing for bringing this case in the wrong forum. And so I would argue to you that the focal point, the timing of that inquiry should have been, I'm only looking at what I knew or what this court could know as of the date of the transfer. And instead, the district court stayed our case for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. And then at the end of that, after all of this other class action investor warfare was taking place, then used that to award sanctions for bringing the case in the wrong forum. And again, we didn't sue these infringers in the first case. But if the court, if the district court was concerned about bringing all of these cases together, there could have been a motion for consolidation. Now, it's the defendants who wanted to treat all of the cases the same. It wasn't the plaintiff, because the plaintiff had reason to be in California. Again, the industry is there. But neither the court sua sponte nor these defendants ever once said, hey, we've got similar facts here. We've got similar parties. We've got all of these similarities here. Let's just consolidate and get on with it. That didn't happen. So, again, I've run over my time 3 times today. I apologize.
It's all right.
Please don't punish my client for misconduct by his former lawyer in other cases. Mr. Lazo isn't perfect, but he didn't do anything wrong in this case. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. I think
I accidentally took this and I wanted to put it back on the podium for the benefit of other counsel.
Fair enough.
Okay. So, yes, I know we're out of time.
I thought you were making another. Okay, fair enough. All right. Thank you, everyone, for your briefing and argument in this case. This matter is submitted, both matters that we've heard today.